Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We need to eat. We need to work. We demand the right to know. We demand freedom. Those are some voices of citizens of China's great metropolis, Shanghai, breaking COVID lockdown rules and gathering in the street to protest. Shanghai's population of 25 million has been ordered to stay at home since the government imposed the lockdown at the end of March. Some 46 cities across China are under full or partial lockdown, affecting the lives of more than 343 million people. That's about exactly the same size as the United States. It's all part of China's COVID zero policy. As infections keep popping up, the government keeps clamping down. Now, other countries have tried COVID zero programs, New Zealand, Taiwan, Vietnam, others, but all of them have pulled back from the goal of total COVID eradication. Only China is holding fast. So today, we're going to ask why and how the COVID zero strategy is having an impact on China and the massive and massively powerful nation being what it is, how that is having an impact on the rest of the world. So let's begin in Shanghai. Don Wineland is there. He's China business and finance editor for The Economist. And he was first on obligatory quarantine. And then the lockdown began at the end of March in Shanghai. So he and his wife have been mostly confined to their hotel for 61 days. Don, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So first of all, tell me sort of what are the conditions of your particular lockdown?
The conditions right now have actually become more strict just over the past 24 hours. We were allowed a little bit of time out over the weekend, but there's been a shift in policy, and things have tightened up and we are back inside. We can't order delivery food anymore, which is, that makes things a lot more difficult. Things just recently have become more difficult for us.
Okay, I said you were confined to your hotel, but should I be more specific? Is it your hotel room that you and your wife have been confined to?
We're in something that's a little bit better than your average hotel room. So we're in a service department. It has two rooms, a small kitchen. So yeah, it's a bit better than an average hotel room.
Okay. Now, beforehand, in previous interviews that you've done, you were able to leave once a day in order to actually go get PCR tested. Is that still going on, or are you literally in your hotel room or your suite 24/7?
So for the past 2 days, we've actually been asked to do the rapid at-home antigen tests in our room. So we haven't gone downstairs for the PCR tests. Prior to that, we had been going down nearly every day to a place just next door to do the PCR test. So we were able to step outside at least once a day. Yeah.
Honestly, Don, how's your mental health right now?
I would say week two, week three, it became that was probably the most difficult period of time. Honestly speaking, I mean, I feel like I've gotten used to it and I've gotten past some of those, feelings of anxiety. My wife is doing very well as well. You know, she has good days, she has bad days. At this point, 61 days in, this is kind of the new reality for us.
Okay. So about food, though, if you can't get food deliveries, how are you and other people in Shanghai? What's the situation now for the basic needs of life?
In the earliest days, it was very difficult to get food, and then it got much better because we could start delivering off of food apps and food services. We have enough to get by for the next few days if they keep this very strict lockdown in place. But the government says that they will deliver food, and we received a package of food today from the government. I actually haven't looked inside. But yeah, I'm not too hopeful. You know, if the government does have to continue providing food, I'm not terribly hopeful that they can provide the best stuff.
Okay, so, but so then to the larger point of the other, you know, sticking with Shanghai for a moment, the other, you know, 25 million plus people in the city, has that been the situation that food, when needed, has been provided by the Chinese government?
In some places, yes. In many places, no. So you were playing some clips of people protesting earlier on. And, you know, I think there's lots of people in this city that have not had adequate access to food. I don't think my situation here is representative of how things work across the city. This is a huge city. So, yeah, there's plenty of people that have struggled to get food for sure.
Okay. So, you know, I know it's a little odd to ask you about what's happening in the rest of Shanghai, given that you haven't been able to leave your hotel or hotel room for more than 60 days here. But as you know, I mean, there have been a lot of waves on social media, reports of increasing anxiety and frustration. I mean, how would you describe what the tenor or tension in the city is right now after a long, prolonged and very severe lockdown?
Yeah, it's an interesting question for somebody who is spending most of their time inside. I was allowed outside on the weekend. So things opened up on Saturday and I was allowed to walk outside. My wife and I had a 2.5 hour walk. So I did get a good look at what was going on. I've lived in Shanghai in the past. And I mean, this city is basically unrecognizable. It's, you know, the streets are completely dead. There's almost nobody outside. There are very few cars. The people that you do see are the, you know, the medical workers in their white hazmat suits. I mean, it's very, very bizarre. Yeah. So it's certainly not its usual self.
Okay. I mean, it's actually almost impossible to imagine a city like Shanghai being so empty and still and quiet. It's eerie. But I mean, just last week, President Xi reiterated this iron-fisted commitment to COVID zero, right? He urged COVID enforcers, essentially, in places like Shanghai and the other cities that are under this extreme lockdown to, quote, unswervingly adhere to the general policy of dynamic COVID zero. So, I mean, tell us more, Don, about what you can gather about the response to that, why this is happening, you know, again, leaning on what you've been experiencing now and your experience overall as a business and finance editor in China for The Economist.
Yeah. So the specific comments from the standing committee of the Politburo that were released last week, I think we are now experiencing that in Shanghai right now. So the increased restrictions, the stopping of food delivery is basically a response, from what we can tell, to that message. So yes, they are really putting a stop to any kind of free movement in order to try to lower cases. And what one interesting thing from that message from the government was that, so in the past they had talked about balancing the COVID response with economic growth. They didn't really have a lot of that language this time. So that means that, you know, they're willing to sacrifice more and more economic growth to control COVID.
Okay, so let's talk about that, Don. I mean, given, again, that you are the China business and finance editor for the Economist, what impact is this having, first of all, on China?
Yeah, so this is the business and finance hub of the country. It's one of the biggest cities in the world. It's one of the biggest manufacturing areas in the world. So naturally, when you lock it down, it has a huge impact. If we're just thinking about, say, industry in China. You know, there are lots of factories, you know, within the city of Shanghai. You know, there's a Tesla factory that Reuters reported that they were slowing down their operations yet again. So there's lots of industrial activity that is suffering greatly right now. There is another side to this as well, which is, you know, small businesses. And, you know, walking outside, the few times that I've had the opportunity to do that, you can see that there nothing is open. No shops are open. It's completely silent. So you can only imagine the type of impact that has on, you know, small business owners and just, you know, average mom and pop type stores.
Okay. And so then inevitably, given, as I said earlier, China being what it is, how do you anticipate that's going to have a ripple effect outside of China?
So in terms of the direct business impact, you know, there's a lot of auto parts and cars that are made in this city and in other parts of China that have been impacted by COVID recently. You know, it takes a long time to build these things and ship them to the US. I think in places like the US, people that have ordered specific models of cars that are produced in these areas, you know, they might not get them on time. They might be delayed significantly. So that's kind of how, you know, that's just one example of, you know, the impact of this kind of rippling around the globe. Another side to this is that a lot of companies will probably expedite their plans to diversify their supply chains. That means opening up a factory in Vietnam or, you know, elsewhere in Asia.
Okay. Well, you know, Don, we've got about 30 seconds left here. Obviously you and other and the many hundreds of millions of Chinese who are under this prolonged lockdown now don't really have a choice. But how long do you think you can keep tolerating it?
It's a really good question. It's something that I talk about almost every day with my wife. We have not set a departure date, so, you know, hopefully we make it through.
And by the way, are you vaccinated?
I'm definitely vaccinated.
With not the Chinese vaccine?
Pfizer.
With Pfizer, okay.
Pfizer and boosted.
Yeah. And nevertheless, being in China right now, you have to stay confined to that hotel room. Well, Don Weiland, yes, China business and finance editor for The Economist, with us from Shanghai. Thank you so much for joining us, Don.
Thanks very much.
Good luck. Okay, so folks, by the way, if you're listening and you have friends or family members in China, in any one of these dozens of cities, including Shanghai, that's still under this COVID zero lockdown that's happening there, what are they telling you? Hop on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. And let us know. We'll have a lot more about why China's adhering to COVID zero when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit. Period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about why, we're trying to understand why China continues to refuse to relent from its COVID zero strategy, the latest chapter of which is the lockdown in dozens of Chinese cities, including Shanghai, more than 340 million people across China under a severe lockdown over the course of several months. I'm joined today now by Yangzhong Huang, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations, also Director of Global Health Studies at Seton Hall University School of Diplomacy and International Relations, and author of Toxic Politics, China's Environmental Health Crisis and Its Challenge to the Chinese State. Yangzhong, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Yangyang Chong, fellow and research scholar at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center, frequent columnist on Chinese politics and U.S.-China relations. Yangyang, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much.
By the way, Yangyang, every time we have you on, we get flooded with emails about how brilliant you are. So we're happy to have you back. So first of all, can you tell us what you're hearing from people that you know, social media that you've been monitoring, about the tenor of or the willingness right now in China for people to continue on with these lockdowns?
This is such a great question. And I think it really, really differs, depends on one's own proximity to the worst consequences of the COVID policies or the pandemic itself. And I'll give you one example. A few weeks ago, I got this message from my mother, who is saying that on how she and her friends are watching the situation in Shanghai and commenting about it. And my hometown, I grew up in the medium-sized city in central eastern China. And she was saying that they are saying how Shanghai, being the richest city in China, is having such a horrible situation and why it is seeming unique in terms of how difficult the situation is. And my mom was saying that, oh, it's because Shanghai is too capitalist, it's too westernized, it's too individualistic. And that's why they didn't handle the lockdown policies well. And initially, when I heard this, I was rather upset. I was like, oh, this is a rather uncharitable thing to say about the city and its people who have been suffering so much. But then I also realized that on one hand, there may be like valid reasons in terms of urban planning, in terms of the distribution of resources that are related with how Shanghai is faring. On the other hand, like China is also a city with extreme geographical disparities. And for people coming from the provinces who've also felt a sense of inferiority and geographical discrimination compared with city people coming from the first tier cities. And so now it seems like the tables are turned and there are very human reactions. However, I think most importantly, when my mother made these comments, it was when there was a cluster of cases that were discovered in my hometown. And so the city was preparing partial lockdowns and other forms of restrictions. So it was really a psychological self-defense mechanism that my mother was deploying, trying to rationalize the situation, trying to find some kind of reason that creates a form of distance between her own situation and the worst situations, the plight that she's been seeing coming out of Shanghai and some of the other cities. And so it was really a way to reclaim power when oneself feels so powerless, both in terms of the virus and in terms of state policies.
Oh, okay. Fascinating. Now, you know, again, outside of China, in a sense, sometimes the best that we can do to understand what is going on in the places where the lockdown is happening is through, you know, some of the social media, before it gets taken down, I should say, that people are putting up. There's one recent viral video that shows this hazmat-suited COVID enforcement officer, essentially, ordering residents to be quarantined after a neighbor tests positive. And in this video, the officer says, "It's not that you can do whatever you want unless you're in America. This is China. Stop asking me why. There is no why. We have to adhere to national guidelines." So, Yangzhong, let me ask you, when we say COVID zero as a policy in China, what exactly does that mean? What is President Xi's goal right now?
Well, that zero COVID policy itself has evolved, right? In the beginning, they want to basically secure the achievements made during the Wuhan outbreak, you know, to maintain extremely low level of infection. And in the meantime, to buy, you know, time, you know, for mass vaccination. You know, but of course now, right, it has changed to the so-called dynamic zero COVID. You know, basically, they just want to nip the crisis in the bud, you know, so to you know,
reset the cases to zero in the shortest time. You know, so once you find just one or two cases, you immediately trigger those zero COVID measures, including mass PCR testing, quarantine, disinfection, and even sealing of the neighborhoods in order to reset the cases to zero. That's not what they mean by zero COVID.
Okay, so reset the cases to zero in that locality.
That's right. Actually, by zero COVID means that the zero cases are found in unquarantined areas only.
Okay. Now, I will say that it wasn't that long ago where, 2020, 2021, in the many, many conversations that we had with public health experts here in the United States, they were saying, in fact, what you're describing, Yanzhong, is the kind of pandemic control measure they would have liked to see in the United States. So not necessarily a blanket shutdown across the whole country, but these more targeted efforts wherever there are outbreaks. I mean, so it's not, in that sense, is what's happening in China not entirely as draconian as maybe the media is making it sound?
Well, it is true. I wish the United States, in the beginning stage of the outbreak, took some of the measures China has undertaken after Wuhan or during the Wuhan. But now I think situation has changed, right? We have the vaccines available. A majority of the population has been vaccinated, and the virus is becoming less virulent, right? That makes it less justifiable to pursue this draconian zero COVID strategy. In fact, if you use the case fatality rate recorded in Shanghai, that is 0.06%, right? Even you assume, right, that the 30% of the population in China infected by Omicron, with Omicron, you have 84,000 deaths, right, in total in the country. So that is not what the policymakers have argued, that if you open up, we're going to see more than 1 million people die.
Okay, but so just so I'm clear, you're saying that across all of China, there's been 84,000 deaths out of 1.3 billion people, roughly.
Oh, I'm talking about, I'm sorry. I assume the 10% infection rate in the entire country, unfettered spread of the virus. That is, even though you don't do anything, right, there will be 84,000 deaths. Of course, if you assume a 30% infection rate, the death toll increased to 250,000. But still, that's far short of what the government has predicted, if China significantly relaxes its policy.
Okay, understood. Yanzhong, I'm going to come back to you in just a moment. But Yanzhong, if I may ask then, is what you're saying that you do not feel that even this dynamic COVID zero policy adhered to by President Xi is necessary in China anymore?
Well, that's the dilemma Chinese leaders are facing, right? If you don't have many severe cases, if you don't have many deaths, right, then you cannot justify that zero COVID is necessary. Because people then will ask, if this is not so virulent, then why bother, right? All these draconian, heavy-handed measures. But, mass die off, a spike of cases, if it does happen, right, it can prove, right, that the China's pandemic response is wrong, right? So I think that that the issue, right, if ultimately it's a political issue, right, that there's a political logic behind China's zero COVID strategy.
Okay, so the possibility of perhaps being proven wrong, that sounds like the political version of the sunk cost fallacy, Yanzhong. I mean, is that what's going on here? How would you examine sort of the political cost-benefit analysis that President Xi might be doing here?
Yeah, absolutely. As Professor Huang said, this COVID-19 policy in China is no longer just a public health measure. It is a political mission. Of course, there are valid concerns with regards to the relatively low elderly vaccination rate, the relatively low efficiency of the Chinese domestic vaccines, as well as the shortage and extreme geographical disparities in terms of the public health resource distributions in China. So these are all valid concerns. However, right now, because zero COVID coming from the central government is so tied with the legitimacy and security of the Chinese political system and is directly coming from the top leadership. So it is very, very difficult for any local officials or municipalities to deviate from that mission. For someone in China to die of COVID-19 is a political mistake, while for someone to die of another reason would just be an individual tragedy. For any local officials in the bureaucracy, adherence to the zero COVID policy is a measure of not just personal technological competence, it's a measure of political loyalty. And very, very importantly, over the past 2 years, the Chinese government at every level of the bureaucracy has built up this massive infrastructure with human power and with institutional and also infrastructure, like actual physical infrastructure to carry out the massive testings and quarantines and lockdowns. And that just by bureaucratic inertia alone is very, very difficult to reverse course.
Huh. You know, I have to say that a politician's fear of being proven wrong is not unique to China, right? I mean, in a sense, that very same human tendency is one of the things that you know, caused a catastrophic response initially to COVID here in the United States. We too had politicians who did not want to be proved wrong, but they just kept claiming the opposite, right? President Donald Trump kept claiming we were going to be, you know, around the corner to beating COVID any second now during all of 2020, which just was not true. And we have 1 million, you know, dead Americans to prove that. So Yang, though, let me ask you, in the Chinese context, though, how powerful is this drive to stay with what has, and I'm going to put this in quotes, worked in China to try to control outbreaks as they continue on, especially given that, you know, I'm sure the Chinese people remain aware and sensitive to the fact that COVID first emerged in China.
Mm-hmm. So I think how powerful on different levels, on a state level, it remains a very powerful policy because it is tied with the top leadership and tied with regime legitimacy and security. On the bureaucratic execution level, I think this is also something that is important. If we look at the so-called Da Bai, the big whites, the ones in hazmat suits that are carrying out the individual testings and lockdowns, including breaking into individual private residences and taking people into centralized quarantine or disinfecting the homes. These people, some of them are medical professionals, some are police officers, but many are migrant workers who have lost their other forms of regular employment because of their manufacturing, construction, or service industries were shut down because of the COVID policies. And so they take on this kind of really rather physically grueling and highly stigmatized work. And these are people who are usually at very low runs of the Chinese society. And now they are being given this form of power tied with the state policy. And this, of course, doesn't apply to every individual, but many are just on a human level would also try abuse their powers as a way to feel a sense of control, a sense of superiority over others who are relatively powerless. Mm. And on the public, on the individual level, who are at the receiving end of these policies, I think this kind of sentiment is also fragmented. On one hand, there is the virus. On the other hand, as Professor Huang also mentioned, that when the virality of the virus has shown to decrease, and then there are other policies in other parts of the world, there are also kinds of concerns. However, as I mentioned earlier, because the Chinese state has built up such a public surveillance and security infrastructure tied with the zero COVID policy, and that is very powerful and may remain in place well after this pandemic phase of this public health crisis has passed, and that is very powerful as well.
I see. So Yan Zhanghuang, are there other vested interests as well? You know, beyond President Xi and the decision-making at the highest levels of Chinese government. Are there other vested interests in maintaining a COVID zero strategy in China?
Oh, absolutely, right. This vested interest, I think, in part to blame for the sustaining of that zero COVID strategy, right? That is, independent Chinese scholars have pointed out that over the past 2 years, China has seen the formation of a powerful interest group, you know, this coalition, right, consisting of the government agencies, you know, that interested in pursuing this Orwellian, you know, surveillance state, even, you know, as Yang Yang's pointed out, even after the end of the pandemic, business entities, including vaccine makers, you know, PCR testing companies, you know, that making, you know, fat profits, you know, from implementing by the zero COVID strategy, you know, then the public health experts, you know, those politically ambitious ones, you know, they care about their own personal career, you know, they're resistant to any significant policy relaxation. And of course, right, the routinization, you know, and institutionalization of that strategy, you know, only, right, further solidify, you know, that alliance.
Fascinating. Okay, so in that case, then though, Yan Zhang, what with the combination of the vested interests and sort of the political cost again for the fear of being proven wrong? I mean, does that how sustainable is it for this even this dynamic COVID zero policy to continue in China? It sounds like it could continue for quite some time.
Well, the common sense is that the weighing by the cost of implementing that strategy exceeded, right, the benefits, right? It's time for China to abandon that approach, as Zheng Guang, you know, a top government health advisor indicated the last summer, you know. But again, you know, now there's the political logic there, right? The political stakes so high, right, that you know, makes those cost issue essentially secondary. So, you know, that means, right, that we are going to see the continuation of that strategy before, right, the 20th Party Congress, because, you know, when that, you know, the leadership transition, right, is, you know, going to happen, right?
Yan Zhang, hang on for just a second. Forgive me for interrupting you. It's just that we have to take this quick break. So Yan Zhang Huang and Yang Yang Chong, stand by. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A little later this week, we're going to be talking about children and mental health, because, of course, there's an increasing mountain of evidence that young people in this country are undergoing, in a sense, a mental health crisis. We're going to focus in particular, though, on children of color who have seen an even greater increase in mental health needs and a diminishment of their mental health over the past couple of years. So families of color, parents, caregivers, what's it been like for your kids? Have you seen a more darker or decrease in your children's mental health, whether it be mild or severe? Have you been able to get the help that you and your child need? We want to hear the stories from families of color. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for a show we're working on later this week. Today, we are talking about China and its continuation of it, now calling it a dynamic COVID zero strategy. Why? What benefit it might be bringing China? What's the cost? And also, again, China being what it is, how it's reverberating around the world. There's a lot of comments coming in here from some listeners here. Robert Bradley says the transmissibility of Omicron is too high and the Chinese vaccine is too weak. Lockdown will not work this time. Ray Russell says the vaccines don't work, plus, or their vaccines, I should say, don't work. Plus, you can't control human nature. You have to let the virus run its course. We made a big mistake locking down along with strangling the economy. We are paying for it now. Caught talking about the U.S. situation. On the flip side, Anna Christina says they, being China, are taking the long-term consequences of infection seriously. They think long-term, while the bumbling idiots in the West only care about the now. We can debate that out a little bit later. But Yanzhong Huang, let me just quickly ask you about the comments here about the Chinese vaccines not working. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, when we say the Chinese vaccines are not working, basically, we mean by that the Chinese inactivated vaccines, which are the most widely used in the country, are not effective in preventing infections, especially against the highly transmissible Omicron variant. But according to studies from Hong Kong, three doses of the Chinese inactivated vaccines actually are effective in significantly reducing the risk of severe cases and death.
Ah, okay. So then let me ask you both, but Yang Chong, let me turn to you here. Because I think a little earlier, you both talked about how there are relatively lower rates of vaccination, especially amongst more vulnerable populations in China. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. It's true that, for example, my mother and my grandmother are not vaccinated yet. And it's a point of extreme worry and frustration for me as well. But I think this is really a situation that needs to be looked at. It's multifaceted. First of all, of course, the Chinese government had embarked and amplified disinformation that discredited the Western vaccines as a way to prove its own superiority and as a way to for it to advance its geopolitical purposes. However, for the domestic vaccines, as Professor Huang mentioned, though its efficacy is limited, it does have efficacy in terms of preventing severe illness. However, the vaccination rate, especially among the elderly, is very low. Like I think the official figure from mid-March from the Chinese government is like 40% of people who are age 80 or over are still unvaccinated, and only about half have received two doses of the domestic vaccine. And I think there are, of course, individual sentiments because of the skepticism with regards to this new product, especially when there is already a longstanding public skepticism with regards to this rapid industrialization and that's effect on environment and public health. And also there have been scandals with regards to Chinese vaccines and food safety and drug safety in general. So there is a public sentiment there and that contributes to vaccine hesitancy. There are also concerns about side effects, etc. But I think it is very, very important here that we do not only blame individuals, however, look at the systemic issues that contribute to this relatively low vaccination rate in the elderly population in China. Now, the Chinese government embarked on a different strategy compared with what is here. That here in the US, for example, like the elderly, the people with pre-existing conditions are prioritized in terms of receiving the vaccine. However, in China, the priority, first of all, was given to people who like work at airports, in customs, transportation worker, or people who travel a lot for business. The people who are considered more likely likely to transmit the virus. And the vaccination is prioritized to people who are like a younger or middle-aged. And of course, there is also this underlying sentiment that the vaccine may not necessarily be so crucial, since there is effectively zero domestic cases up until quite recently. And also, there is also the reason of resource access. Now, for a lot of elderly people who may not be so adept at digital technologies, who may lack access to transportation and other forms of resources, and who may just not know how or where to get these kinds of vaccines. And that is a problem we don't just see in China, but around the world as well, that the most marginalized are most impacted.
Yeah, no, point well taken. But, you just said so many interesting things, Yang. I'm not even sure how to follow up. But Yan Zhong, let me turn to you, because I hear everything that Yang Chong just described. And at the same time, in China, we see a nation that essentially built hospitals overnight, right? Early on in the pandemic, that mobilized, as you've both talked about, this deep structure for pandemic control and surveillance that is capable of enforcing a lockdown to this day of 340 million people. So what is the reason for the prolonged lower vaccination rate, surprisingly lower vaccination rate, amongst the elderly and most vulnerable? I heard what Yang Chong said about individual skepticism and the reasons for that. But if you're the Chinese government and you really want to achieve COVID elimination, wouldn't you want to get a vaccine program as far and widespread across the country as possible?
Well, absolutely. Well, here actually, it reveals this tensions between zero COVID strategy, right, and a strategy that prioritized at-risk population, including the elderly. Right. The biggest problem is that zero COVID cannot tolerate any infections. Right. But we know even the best vaccines, right, cannot do that.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
And secondly, right, zero COVID, as Yang just indicated, right, shields a population, right, from the virus. You know, that created a false sense of security among the population, right? So if we are feeling safe, why bother to get vaccinated, right? And then third problem also has something to do with the implementation of the zero COVID is that when, like in Shanghai, you mobilize most of the health professionals to enforce the quarantines, to provide PCR testings, right? Basically, you don't have much manpower, right, left to administer the vaccines. In fact, beginning March, mid-March, Shanghai closed, many vaccination sites.
Oh, okay. So interesting. Now, if you both allow, for a moment, I just want to sort of take a little tangential look at another country that also initially embraced a very, very rigorous COVID zero strategy. No one's quite like China, but I think it's instructive to look at other nations that wanted to achieve elimination. And so New Zealand being one of them. They had those very strict lockdowns early on in the pandemic. And in fact, for many, many months, the rest of the world looked at New Zealand as a paragon of COVID control because they were highly, highly successful. But in October of 2021, 7 weeks into an outbreak of the Delta variant, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced the end of Auckland's COVID zero strategy.
But as you can see, with this outbreak and with Delta, the return to zero is incredibly difficult. And our restrictions alone are not enough to achieve it quickly. In fact, for this outbreak, it's clear that long periods of heavy restrictions has not got us to zero cases.
Again, that was October of 2021. So more than 6 months have passed since then. And that's why we contacted Judith McCool, who heads the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of Auckland.
New Zealand's experiment with the zero COVID policy was a process of trial and error, really, and also a bit of watch and learn, see what was happening in other countries.
Now, early on in the pandemic, as I mentioned, what New Zealand saw around the rest of the world was chaos. So they opted for an almost total shutdown.
We did the hard mahi, as we call it in New Zealand. We'd impose reasonably severe mobility restrictions, border lockdowns, social isolation, etc., really early on. No one leaves the home unless they're an essential worker. We really didn't know enough, but we certainly knew that our health systems just weren't going to cope with what was appearing to unfold in other countries.
But then came the Delta variant, which could not be fully controlled in New Zealand. And as mentioned before, October 2021, New Zealand ended its COVID zero strategy.
We were becoming increasingly aware of the loss of appetite. We just didn't have the guts to go through another severe lockdown experience. For New Zealand, it wasn't so much just ripping off the Band-Aid and just letting it run rampant. Importantly, I think one difference that we had in New Zealand was because we had a really high vaccination rate in our most vulnerable populations. So we had an over 95% vaccination rate in our oldest age group. We were slower off the mark with our other vulnerable populations, so our Pacifica, our Maori population. So this was not an equitable strategy for these populations. But overall, we were able to go, okay, we do not need to do severe restriction and lockdown.
Now, as of March of 2022, New Zealand's death toll stood at just 68. But the highly transmissible Omicron variant has pushed that number up by more than a factor of 10. Now, more than 800 New Zealanders have died, but it's still one of the lowest per capita COVID death rates in the world. So Judith McCool says life is more or less back to normal.
We still have mask wearing in retail stores. We can come into our workplaces now. We can move about relatively freely. We can go to large gatherings. I mean, I attended the graduation for Auckland University yesterday, and it was, you know, a large number of students. The staff were masked on the graduation stage. Students were a mixture, and family as well. So that is permissible. People are making their own decisions about what's right for them.
So in New Zealand, people making their own decisions, as Judith McCool just said, about what's right for them. That's working for them now, not a COVID zero strategy. So we asked, what does McCool make of China and its continued choice to stick with an elimination strategy?
My advice for China, if I was to be audacious enough to offer it, would be to listen to your populations. Really, really carefully. Communication is so incredibly important. People in New Zealand were willing to really, you know, knuckle down and shut their doors and not see family, not bid farewell to loved ones before they died, because they believed it was for the good of the whole. So I would say to China, not coming down heavy on top, but coming up from and saying, in working with those communities, invest in that communication.
So that's Judith McCool, head of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of Auckland. Now, Yang Chong, you know, I understand that it might seem a little foolish to ask someone in Auckland to comment on decision-making in Beijing, but I wonder what you make of that. I mean, she's coming at this from a public health perspective about listening to the mood and the willingness of people in lockdown in China and advising the government to communicate better with them.
Yeah, I myself agree with the comments. However, I think also, as we've discussed earlier in this conversation, the Chinese government's COVID policy is really not just about public health, and it has a lot of exterior concerns with regards to regime legitimacy and security, with regards to other forms of political control. As Professor Huang mentioned, all these types of additional interests that are now connected with the COVID-19 policy. One thing I should also mention, right, in terms of the mobility of people, both the border control, both not letting people coming in and also not letting people go out, and this kind of atomized grid-like surveillance network that really would last beyond this crisis phase of the pandemic. And these are the things that the state had invested in. So this is not just about what is most effective for a COVID-19 response, but this is really about how the Chinese state calculates its many conflicting interests and try to make a judgment government in terms of what is the best for its political control in the immediate term.
Oh, fascinating. You know, and I understand that, I mean, Yanzhang Huang, there is something of a, I don't know how we characterize the what debate looks like in China, but there have been reports that, for example, Professor Tong Zhiwei at Shanghai's East China University of Political Science has written a letter that the lockdowns form a kind of legal disaster and that the Chinese government needs to balance people's rights and freedoms, and local governments in China need to do so too. What do you make of that? Is there, you know, a sort of legal pushback even from within China?
Well, we have to remember that there's all these dissenting voices, you know, mostly from Shanghai. They represent the loudest, most articulate voices, you know, from China. And so, you know, when we talk about listening to the mood of the population, I still think a majority of the population continue to support zero COVID with limited access to alternative information. So I think it's more important to educate the public about true risk posed by the virus, you know, that we cannot expect China to come out of the woods without the rise of the cases, as, you know, the deputy director of China, former deputy director of China CDC,
say. Yes, well, Yanzhang Huang, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you so very much. And Yang Chong, Fellow and Research Scholar at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center, thank you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.